Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Calajaris, Vice President of Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. And today we're extremely excited to have with us Rochelle Williams, who is a lifelong passionate designer of all kinds. She is currently the lead product designer for Elsewhen, and just someone who I think has a really good sense of the holistically what it takes to really succeed in design. So we're extremely excited to have you here, Rochelle. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
All right. We're going to start. Tell me a little bit about sort of what was your path into design? What's your origin story as a designer, Rochelle?
Sure. So I thought I'd kind of zoom out a little bit because as some people can probably tell from my accent, I'm not from the UK or from the US, originally from Australia, and kind of obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but like grew up at home with my parents and my older sister. And my parents kind of, because of their jobs a little bit, decided to move around a bit when I was a kid. So kind of had a childhood split across Australia and the UK and New Zealand. And that actually kind of bled into my university. So I ended up studying my first 2 years in Auckland in New Zealand at a university called AUT, and then did my third year at Curtin University in Perth in Western Australia. And the reason I kind of just wanted to start there is because I actually think that origin story of kind of doing my study across two different universities that have very different styles, I think kind of started me on a generalist track. I don't think I really clocked that at the time, but now I really lean into kind of being a generalist and personally think it's a great kind of way to be as a product designer because it's a really varied role. There's a lot of different skills you need to have. And as part of the reason I'm very passionate about soft skills and power skills, which I think we're going to be talking about a little bit today. But maybe before we get into that, I'll just give you a brief kind of professional history. So I started off in kind of agency land in Australia in my first job. I was lucky enough to work at quite a small studio that did a very diverse range of things. So I learned a bit of coding, even Python when I was kind of early 20s. I even did a bit of kind of startup business and product strategy stuff with them because they used to invest in a few startups. And obviously a lot of design, like brand design, graphic design, digital design, and a little bit of UX design. So that was as well a great kind of starting point to lean into my kind of generalist designer kind of trajectory. And then decided to make the move across to the UK, to London, because I was, you know, obviously an ambitious designer out of uni. I'd spent a couple of years in Perth. But if you don't know much about Perth, like, lovely place, beautiful beaches. My parents still live there with their three dogs, but it's maybe not the place to kind of like grow that career trajectory as much. So I kind of decided to move to London. As I'd lived in the UK before, I already had quite a good network here that I was keen to tap into. So yeah, moved out here. I actually, interestingly, originally wanted to start in branding strategy and really like hit all the kind of branding studios and agencies that I was following in Australia. But it's actually, and I think it probably still is, it's a very competitive field. And trying to go straight for a job like that, also with no kind of UK-based experience, I basically run out of track at a certain point and ended up kind of taking on a freelance job. I'm kind of intentionally being quite honest about this because I think it's good to hear, you know, that absolutely. Not everyone has a success story necessarily from the start when they do something quite big, like move cities like that. So I did, you know, that first year in London was quite tricky. I think I was kind of finding my own way. But my first full-time job I secured was at another kind of small marketing agency called Craven Lamb. And the interesting thing about that role was that literally like 6 weeks after I was hired, they were actually bought out. And obviously this was all happening before I was hired, but I wasn't aware of
that. Right, didn't come up in the interview.
Exactly, it didn't come up. They probably weren't allowed to talk about it.
No, they didn't.
Exactly. But yeah, so they were bought out by a big kind of marketing advertising conglomerate called V Global. And they had, you know, like global offices across the world, like thousands of people employed. So So it was a totally different kind of beast to what I thought I was working at. But it actually ended up working out really well for me because they had a kind of UX and product design team internally because they produced their own kind of e-commerce marketing products. So at one point they ran a little internal training course for all of the designers at the company to kind of upskill them in that user-centered design. And during that, I kind of had this moment of realization that, wow, this like training course I'm doing after hours is the most interesting part of my job. How can I make that, you know, the job I'm getting paid to do, basically? So yeah, like a few months later, one of their senior product designers resigned and I kind of, you know, went in there and talked to my boss and talked to the boss of the product design department and kind of got myself hired as an internal, more junior hire when that person left, which was a really great thing to do looking back because I was actually working with a couple of super senior people that had actually taught the General Assembly course. Have you heard of General Assembly in the US? So they were, you know, obviously very, very good product designers, really good base of like the kind of process you need to follow in product design and good UX, like best practices, but had also both had quite a lot of experience training other people. So basically the perfect place for me to join as like a junior product designer. So I stayed there for a little while and then actually decided to tap into another kind of industry that I'd been thinking about for a while, which is basically finance. Because I mean, when you're in London, one of the finance centers of the world, right? So like I just happen to know quite a bit about finance. My fiance is in finance. My dad's always worked in finance. My mom has done quite a lot in finance. So I was like, you know, I feel like I should be putting that knowledge to use. And it's also something I was quite interested in at the time. So at that point, I moved to a fintech startup. And to be honest, like fintech startups in London then, and probably still now, are quite appealing. Like they're quite cool kind of places to work. So I kind of wanted a taste of that startup life. And that was great. So this was a startup called Bud in London, who's still going. So they basically work with open banking technology. So that was a great job to actually progress my technical skills more. They worked a lot with APIs and machine learning. I also worked very closely with front-end developers, which I'd done in the past, but was great to kind of refine those skills a little bit more. Things like building component libraries alongside a developer. So that was great. And then basically decided that I was kind of missing the variety from agency life a little bit. So then moved to my current role at Elsewhen, which is a digital transformation consultancy. But I might talk a little bit more about my progression at Elsewhen and what we do there a bit later in the session. Because I think probably enough on my kind of personal journey for now.
No, but I think you're right. I think it's good both for all of us to remember it's not all, you know, it's not all one direction. You know, I started, everything went swimmingly and I was at the top. But also I think for myself and for a lot of listeners too, the variety makes such a difference. And the perspective and things you learn at a small startup versus something established, depending on who you're under, there's all of those different ways season us in ways that just add so many layers, which I think is great. But as you alluded to, what we're going to talk today a little bit about is a topic I know that you love to speak on and I think is a really important topic, which is power skills. So let's talk a little bit about power skills, what those are, and sort of like maybe power skills versus soft skills a little bit as well.
Sure. So yeah, as you said, really, really excited to be talking about power skills. I've kind of given a talk around power skills a couple of times and I'm working on a few articles around it. First thing I wanted to cover is that kind of semantics terminology piece. Because I think more and more these days people are hearing the term power skills, but some of your listeners might have only heard soft skills or maybe leadership skills and behaviors. To me, all of these things are kind of in the same bubble. But the reason I personally use power skills is it just feels like a much more accurate term for what you can actually get from these skills. And it almost like reminds you that if you refine and hone these power skills, then that kind of gives you power in the workplace. It literally will, you know, mean you can drive that innovation, mean you can have bigger impact on strategy and all those kind of things. But I thought I might actually just read out a little quote that I found from, I think this is the first person to talk about this soft skills shift into power skills. So he's President Hanlon of Dartmouth College. And he actually talked about this way back in 2016. So he says, these skills are not soft skills. These are power skills. Power indicates something much more important and meaningful, creates a sense of necessity. soft skills sound like mushy nice to haves, but power skills sound like a must have. So that kind of hits the nail on the head for me as to why I personally call them power skills. And I think it's just, yeah, as I said, much more of a capturing term of what you're trying to achieve out of these skills.
And I think it's also really smart because I do think sometimes soft skills are dismissed in their importance. And I do think that as women too, we often are very strong in some of these areas, but it's a way of being like, oh, well, that's nice. That's not important. But it is important. And it is important and powerful. And so I think it's a great and important change to sort of the lexicon in the space.
Yeah. I might just add one more thing onto that as like something that I talk about a lot when I talk about power skills is technical skills are great, almost like up to a certain point in your career. So I think I'm not saying that people shouldn't worry about refining technical skills. It's still super important, particularly if you kind of get up to like, say, mid to senior level. I think that is probably the place you should be spending your time. However, when you're trying to do that jump from senior to lead or senior to manager, that is when you really need to be thinking about these power skills. And I might just mention a few so people know what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
It's things like facilitation, collaboration, negotiating, conflict management, stakeholder management. All that kind of stuff that we know is gnarly, but like people don't really talk about. And you might not actually be like graded on in your progression frameworks, which is something that I have some experience with elsewhere that I can talk about a little bit. And I ended up kind of bringing some of these power skill behaviors into our framework so that I kind of could give myself opportunities to express those because I felt that that was what was kind of holding me back from progressing into that lead role.
And I do think I would echo that. We talk about that a lot also in the product management space, that the difference between a director of product management and a product manager is not who writes the better requirements, right? It is, in fact, who has a better sort of business savvy and business sense and some of these other power skills. And I think that's also true with designers, right? There is a point. You absolutely have to have those skills, but that is not what's going to get you to the next better, that you have a stronger UX design. It's going to be these other things. So if that's the area you want to go, which is okay too if it's not, but if it is, right, then these are the places that you need to invest in understanding, building, and demoing.
Yeah. I actually feel, just to follow up on something you said there, personally, I feel that because one thing that happens that comes up quite a bit in kind of design progression conversations is this idea of the individual contributor track and the management track. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I think these power skills are more key for the management track. But I actually think as you're getting to that kind of like, I don't know, everyone seems to call these roles slightly different things. But as you're getting to that kind of like super senior product designer, let's call it, like, I do think you're going to find yourself in conversations with a client, in conversations with someone like a head of product. And I do think those skills are still useful if you're going to stay on that individual contributor track, especially as you get super senior, whatever you want to call that.
No, I think you're absolutely right, too. I mean, the skills will always serve you, and a lack of these altogether is never going to help you. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Individual contributor or management track, these are important. Okay, so we talked a little bit about what they are. Let's like dig in. Like you mentioned some specifics. Like let's dig in into what those are and what you mean by those.
Sure. So yeah, obviously at Elsewhere we use quite a few different power skills. But I thought I'd just pick up on two or three today that I feel like will resonate with designers, particularly, especially if you're trying to, you know, create that impact in your organization and maybe either progress yourself or progress people in your team that you're working with. So the first one I want to start with is facilitation, which I mentioned, and I think is often kind of a hot topic in product design and UX. But I want to start by actually flipping the word facilitation into a behavior, because I personally find behaviors much easier to kind of understand how to improve at. So the behavior that I have transferred facilitation into is enable decision making. So if you're, you know, going into a meeting tomorrow with a group of people that you know tend to not really align, and it's one of those where you just chat for 45 minutes and nothing really gets decided by the end of it, you know, being that person that is enabling decision making, I feel like is almost a really clear like call to action of, okay, if you are taking on that responsibility in that meeting, it is your job to enable those decisions to be made. So how are you going to do that, right? Like, I'm going to talk about a few tips. So first one, know what drives your stakeholders. So I think, again, this is kind of a basic thing that people talk about, but I feel that elsewhere in my last couple of roles, I've started taking it to another level of depth. So you don't just want to know their name and their role. You really want to know what is motivating these stakeholders in the room. And just a quick aside, this framework I've tried to make work for either kind of agency consultancy side, but also in-house, because I have a lot of experience working in-house as well. And I know that stakeholders can also be, internal stakeholders can be just as challenging to work with as external stakeholders. So yeah, if you're going into, say, a creative workshop with the CEO at your startup, what are their motivations and goals for that workshop? They might be a little bit different to yours. So just think about that, especially when you're kind of designing the exercises that you're going to go through. And following on from that, make sure you have that structure in the workshop to ensure all the different types of stakeholders, their voices get heard, but also enable them to be aligned, because that's really what this enabled decision making is about. It's you first need to align in order to be able to make a decision the whole group is comfortable with. So if you're taking on that role, as I said, you need to be building that structure around that. Second tip on facilitation or enabled decision-making, think about making workshops more bespoke. So I think, and this can apply to meetings, I think, as well, but I use workshops because we tend to build a bit more structure around workshops. Mm. You might use a fig jam or a Miro board. I actually really encourage everyone, even if you're in kind of a fairly random meeting, say with even a couple of other designers, often at Elsewhere, we will get up a fig jam board, you know, 5 minutes into that meeting and just start putting things on post-it notes and arranging them. And it's amazing how you can actually build that structure even around what feels like a fairly loose meeting. But if you are using kind of a base workshop template, say something like customer journey mapping, another thing you can do is kind of questioning the status quo of that workshop. So there might be certain swim lanes that you always use, things like, you know, the emotional journey, and like tasks and touch points. But maybe for this particular project you're working on, there might be something a bit more specific. For example, I was actually chatting to our director of product yesterday about a productivity project we did with Spotify. And because it was all around productivity, for them, instead of that kind of emotional line, we had a productivity line, which means you could see the dips and peaks in the team's productivity and really hone in on where we could be improving that productivity in their kind of process. And finally, like, we have a bit of a catchphrase at Elsewhen, which is we try and put as much kind of thought and effort and design finesse into our workshops as we would designing a product. Hmm. Like, our workshop boards are kind of something to behold. We spend some time putting our workshops together, but that's because, particularly as a consultancy, that kind of hour or two workshop with the client, say kicking off a project, is invaluable for us because we don't always have heaps of time for them. So yeah, I think really consider your workshop design as part of your design process, not just go and grab a template and that'll work. And the last one on this is kind of similar to the bespoke workshops, but it's all about being adaptable. So a few things you can do to be adaptable. If you are building that kind of workshop structure in something like Fig Jam, one thing you can do is break a session up into smaller chunks. So you might have an hour, but you've got, you know, 3 20-minute chunks, which means if the first chunk is maybe not going very well and you feel that you're not getting much from it, maybe you don't actually spend 20 minutes on it. You only spend 10 minutes on it. And actually the second chunk you're getting heaps from and you're like, actually, I feel like we should stick with this and even cut the final one so that we can really get as much as we can from this exercise. So that's one. Another thing to remember, particularly kind of post-COVID, is think about how you're structuring your session, depending if it's in-person fully, remote fully, or hybrid. Particularly if it's hybrid, even try and encourage the right amount of people in each setting. For example, I find it quite tricky if there's just one person remote. So maybe even if there's a couple of people on your team, maybe one of you is also remote, so that they can kind of be keeping an eye on the remote team in that workshop, if that makes sense.
I think those hybrid ones are very tough.
They are tough. And to be honest, like, it's something we're still working on how to kind of improve doing them at Elsewhen. I actually went to another conference recently all around Web3 and kind of AI and that kind of stuff. And there was a very interesting talk around holograms and this idea of like a Jedi council.
Right? Like, I like totally went right there.
Right? Like, and can you imagine it, right? And
it's absolutely.
Like, feet, you have the perception that everyone's in person, which I thought was a really quite cool concept. I would be very keen to try out their beta if they do a beta. But yeah, I think it's something that we're all kind of thinking about more. Do you want me to go through another one?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of good things on facilitation. And I do think it's also one of those areas that designers tend to be strong, but mm-hmm. sometimes we also take for granted where our strengths are, right? And I think this is just being super intentional into leaning in on those and putting a little bit of extra effort in, whether it is something internal to the design group you're doing, internal within the organization, or external with a client, that spending a little more time in here is going to get you significantly more rewards for that session, as well as I think would, again, is a very good demonstration of this type of power skill.
Yeah, exactly. I love a word you use there, by the way, intentional. Mm. We use that word intentional a lot at Elsman, and I actually think it's a really key concept in product design, just having that intentionality in everything you do.
Awesome. All right. So that's facilitation. I know that's not the only power skill. So give me another one.
I'll ask you actually, should we pick between, I've got some stuff here on conflict management and momentum, two very different vibes.
Ooh, two very good ones. Let's do conflict management first and then.
I was going to pick that. I'm glad you picked that.
Excellent.
The reason I quite like conflict management is because this might sound ironic. I am a very kind of, what's the word when you don't like conflicts?
You're conflict averse.
Yeah, I'm one of those. Like it makes my palms sweat. So that was why for this one as well, I did this thing of creating a behavior that slightly flips it on its head. So my behavior for conflict management is debate constructively. Because for my brain, spinning it to the positive as well as being behavior really helps me kind of digest improving at conflict management.
Really changes your mindset as well.
Yeah.
Right? If we're having a lot of people really enjoy a debate.
Yeah.
And someone can mean to be debating, but it can feel like conflict to the other one. I suppose some people like conflict, but most people really don't, right? Different degrees of aversion there. But but setting it up for debate is a healthy conversation and really also takes the emotions out of that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a great framework to flip on.
And that emotion thing is one of my tips. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. There's a great book I read, was it last year or maybe the year before, called Think Again by Adam Grant, who is an organizational psychologist. Super interesting book. If you're interested in this kind of topic, I would highly recommend reading it. But he has this concept around questioning like a scientist when you get into these debates. So that kind of means we tend to automatically be kind of that preacher, prosecutor, politician role. But actually, if exactly what you were saying, if you want to kind of take that emotion out of the room, it's really helpful to actually put you in that scientist mindset. And that means you're thinking about the facts. You're thinking about asking questions. Mm. You're thinking about bridging gaps in knowledge between maybe you and the person you're talking to. And maybe you're thinking about, maybe we don't even have to agree because scientists don't always agree, right? You have your theory, I have my theory. We can agree to disagree. But actually asking questions and learning more about the other person's theory that disagrees with you will probably help you in your kind of championing of whatever you're trying to do. So I really like that concept just as a kind of clear way of taking that emotion out. Another one for conflict management is actually one of our values at Elsman, which is clear is kind. So this one's all about feedback. So if you're giving negative feedback, which tends to be the default, let's be honest, make sure it's specific, relevant, actionable. Mm. Basically, like, don't just be like, I didn't like how you were in that meeting. Like, what am I supposed to do about that? Like, be clear about, like, I didn't like the specific behavior because X, Y, Z in that meeting. But actually, I think more importantly for this one is the positive feedback, because I think generally we don't give and receive enough positive feedback, and it can make a massive difference to someone's day or someone's week. Like even other people, giving other people in your team positive feedback in like an open forum like Slack or Teams, like it can really change someone's mindset for that day. So yeah, remember to give people positive feedback, and that should also be that kind of actionable, relevant, effective, clear, specific feedback. Don't just be like, you were great in that meeting. Why were they great in that meeting? What was it that they did in that meeting that was great? Because if you know your strengths, you know the stuff you don't have to worry about improving. It's just as important as knowing your weaknesses, right?
It's so true, because you do think about that. I think we are more, again, to use the word intentional, about giving specifics when it's negative, because you're trying to like grow. But when you're just excited to give a compliment and people are excited to get one and they're like, yay, I was great. And then it was like, to your point, give the specifics, then they can repeat those behaviors, not just aim for those same reaction. And I think that's really smart.
Yeah. Like, for example, me personally, like this other power skill that we're not talking about is around like momentum, which I kind of talk about as leading motivationally. This is something that just my general personality type kind of lends itself towards.
Yes.
So I'm naturally kind of better at that power skill than something like conflict management. And because people have told me that, I now know I can focus more of my kind of training time or my refining time on conflict management and skills like that, as opposed to the stuff I already know how to do, because I already know how to do that. I'll just add one more point for conflict management. So it's a bit similar to the facilitation stuff, but I think also relevant for this one, is adding structure and focus, particularly when you're asking for feedback. So my favorite example for this is something like a design critique. I'm sure we've all been to a design critique
with people
in there that are not designers, and you're asking for everyone's feedback, and people love giving designers feedback. Design is one of those things that everyone thinks they can do, partly because everyone can see it and kind of understands it to a certain point, which is great. Like, that's an exciting thing about design. It's a form of communication. Like, that means it's doing its job. But it does mean, unlike things like, say, coding or, you know, accounting, I don't know, dog grooming, although actually dog grooming you probably actually can see. That's a bad example. I got a dog recently, which is why dog grooming is on the mind. But yeah, generally adding structure and kind of focused points to when you're asking for design feedback can really help you kind of cut through any tension in the room. Like say, I'm sure we've all put a prototype together and you haven't really worked on the UX copywriting too much yet. You're just kind of doing a first build to see if the general concept works and kind of flows together. And then immediately you start receiving feedback on, why have we used the word they here? Why is this this? But like, if you had just said up front, look, I haven't worked on the UX copy, I just want feedback on the journey, then people know not to give you feedback on that.
Yep.
And it kind of removes any of that tension and means you get more feedback on the thing you actually wanted feedback on. So yeah, I think that's a really important one to remember as well.
Absolutely. Now, you did touch a little on momentum and leading motivationally. And this one is one where, like you, it is probably one of my more natural strengths. Mm-hmm. It's also one of the things I find the most fun, right? So, you know, maybe there's the how good I am at it, but there's how much I enjoy it too, right? Like there's both of those. And again, a place I think where a lot of designers have some natural skills. And so I think it is a place where you can lead a lot without a leadership title, and you can lead a lot of different kind of things in an organization. And if this is a happy place for you, use it, show it, and use it in all kinds of different spots. And if it's not a happy place for you, it is one to work on, because that you know, again, what you just need a follower to be a leader, right? Just one to get started. And the power that comes with that is key. And the ability to get things done and to get the kind of things that you believe in done, a lot of that is led through the ability to build momentum.
Yeah, definitely.
Another sort of power skill that I know you touch on sometimes, which I'm not sure that everybody thinks of in this way, is self-management.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's super interesting. So if we can talk a little bit about self-management and why it's so important and sort of how to build it up, that would be great.
Sure, definitely. So basically, if you're not sure what we mean by the term self-management, I actually find it useful to sometimes think of as almost like entrepreneurship in yourself. So I actually think one role that's really good at self-management generally are product managers, because they are kind of the mini CEO in a product team. Like, they really care about the kind of business strategy, what everyone on the team is doing. Is this thing going to be like monetarily successful one day? All that kind of stuff. So this self-management idea is almost like you managing yourself to be successful, if that makes any sense. So yeah, as I said, like things like, think like a business owner. So even if you're not like that product person on a team, sometimes that person isn't on the team, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. it's just designers and engineers and you're working directly with the CEO, and maybe you're working on a whole new business tangent for like a CEO at the startup, right? So you actually need to think just as much like a business owner as that CEO does, because they'll massively respect you for that if you can kind of show them a design that has all of that thought behind it. So as I mentioned, some of those things like who's the market for this project? Who's the target audience? What's the cost structure going to be? Like what are the stages to release? Is there an alpha, a beta, and a go live? So start thinking about that kind of stuff. Other things more about almost like personal behaviors, a bit less about projects. So one that I massively preach is own your calendar. And what I mean by that is basically lots of little micro behaviors with your calendar. So you can probably tell I'm a planner just from the way I talk. I'm slightly obsessed with planner, but I actually don't have a to-do list at work. I use my calendar as my to-do list, because I actually find to-do lists a bit annoying and they just end up growing and growing and growing, and I find it a bit demotivating. And I have this problem where I will sit at my computer, and if I don't, especially if I have a day with no meetings, because I've had other jobs where I'm just in meetings 70% of my day. So to have a whole day with no meetings, I'm like, oh my God, you know, there's like, it's the blank page issue. Like, yep. How do I motivate myself on what to work on first? So what I do is previous Rochelle, probably the previous week, has chunked out that day into like, right, okay, I wanted to work on this article. I have some time, so I'm going to spend a couple of hours working on that article. I need to do this image for this thing from sales that someone asked me for last week. I need to reply to that email. I need to, you know, line up with Rebecca when we're recording this podcast, whatever it is. So I think having that kind of time boxed, almost like to-do list in your calendar, I find super helpful, and just kind of gives you that control back if you're feeling a bit demotivated and a bit like you never really know what you're doing with your day. And it also means, like, I find I tend to do stuff that I wouldn't have found the time to do because it's really easy just to get distracted on this kind of reactive ad hoc tasks. Like, everyone's Slack is always going 100 miles an hour, people asking them for random requests. But if you already had the 2 hours in your calendar after lunch putting aside to work on that article and someone has asked you to do something else, it's then your decision. You don't just say yes. You think about it and you're like, well, I was going to do this thing. What thing is the best thing for me to do? Do I say to this person, I'll do that thing tomorrow or after I finish the thing I was going to do? Because if you didn't have anything in your calendar, you would have just said yes.
Yep.
So I think that's a great one. And any boss will massively appreciate you being a bit more strategic about your own priorities, even if you're like not a senior role. So yeah, think about that. And obviously, if you're not sure of the priority, you can always ask. But I think as much of that stuff you can do yourself, that is just putting you in that kind of senior leadership mindset for your seniors.
And I think like your calendar approach too, it's one of those things we talk about, the urgent versus important.
Yeah.
And if you as an individual can find the time to get the important work done, not just the urgent, then that's you really start to move the needle in a different way. And it can be very hard, because it's also, while it can be bad to have a checklist, it can be satisfying to check things off, right? That's one of the other reasons you can get really sucked into it, because you're like, but look at how many things I crossed off today. This was a very productive day. I feel good about it.
Yeah.
But then again, it's easy to lose some of the bigger initiatives and pieces if we do that.
Yeah. I think one thing I would say as well on that is like, I love that. And also adding on to that, something that I find I do, which is just to watch a little bit, and it's like a classic kind of project management thing, is just to chunk those tasks. Like, don't put a 2-hour block in your calendar of solve the design team's operations, right? Because you're not going to do that in 2 hours.
You don't think you can do that in 2 hours?
Every time you get to that and you're putting your head in your hands and you're like, oh my God, I can't even face starting that. Like, instead, put something like kick off, like start a Notion document, email your boss about what's the first thing we're doing about this, set up a meeting, although you shouldn't set up too many meetings, so make that the default. But, you know, like, what's the first thing you can do to get the ball rolling on that thing?
Break it down into more consumable, achievable pieces. Yeah,
exactly. And just one more on the self-management one, which I quite enjoy, particularly as you're getting more senior, just trust your instincts to push back. It sounds really simple, but I think too often, like, particularly as a woman, actually, I think this is more relevant, but, you know, not all men, hashtag not all men. Like, basically, I think a lot of us are people pleasers. I would definitely put myself in that bracket. So when you're, and especially if you're pushing back against someone like your boss or a founder mm-hmm. or a CEO or someone like that, it doesn't feel like the right thing to do. It feels like you're going to upset that person. But actually, often that person just doesn't have the headspace to think about stuff in as much depth as you might be thinking about it for like that specific kind of thing, that specific piece of the pie. So if you feel like you've been kind of going down this trajectory and you just have this vibe, you're like, I just think we might be going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a few red flags, and maybe you're not sure if other people have seen them. You're assuming they have, but they might not have. So just bring it up and, you know, have an open conversation with whoever's kind of like opening that project. And, you know, just remember that you were hired for your expertise. So if you use that expertise to tell someone more senior to you, you know, that they might want to change track a little bit, like that, they should appreciate that. So yeah, try and get the confidence to do that. I think that's a really important one as well.
I think it is a really, really important one. And again, I think it's, I always say that, you know, well, they pay you for your opinion, right? Like they're not just looking for yes and I said, and if it's really, really important, then they're paying you to give your opinion twice, right? Yeah. Like, then at some point you've got to be, okay, I've done it and now I'm going to do everything to make it work, right? Like, that's always got to be the default. I'm not away, but it is a real miss. I think it's a responsibility of us. And again, as we move up the ladder, I think it becomes more and more a responsibility. You can't just, you know, ole and watch it go by. You do need to speak up and give your reasoning, yeah. right? Like, I mean, this is not like it's dumb, right? And obviously that's not what we're talking about.
No, exactly. But
right. But it's how you do. But I think it is a really, really important skill.
Definitely. So self-management is a fun one.
Yes. Yes. And again, I think something people don't necessarily think about as, oh, I should, you know, this is a power skill, but I think it really is. And as a boss, it's a really valuable skill in an employee when they come with that. Right. Yeah. And the amount of trust I have when they're building those plans and delivering on them without my intervention, it's a different level of employee.
Yeah. You're making me think I need to do another like chapter, I think, on assertiveness. I've been thinking about assertiveness a lot recently, particularly around women and power skills. Mm-hmm. Because also one of the places I looked at for research on this topic, there's like an education place here, and they did a study around basically like hiring gaps in our industry and like what people are looking to upskill in. And I think assertiveness, the interest in the skill assertiveness had gone up 250% between 2021 and 2022, which I just thought was insane. So it just shows that people really appreciate it as a skill. So like, we should all figure out how to be more assertive.
I actually, to think, so we work with a lot of product managers and we work with a lot of designers. And I think this is sometimes an area of conflict between the two groups is the level and type of assertiveness. I think product, and we're going to do some 100% going to do some stereotype grouping here that is not true of everybody. Like, be super clear. Right? Yes. Right. Be super clear. Product managers, very type A personalities. So lots of plan, lots of direct, lots of move fast, lots go like bullet points, let's just go. And I think designers often with the level of empathy we bring to our projects are, if we give feedback, it is not as direct, right? Yeah. When we give it, we are thinking about how it's going to be perceived and we're thinking about the person and we're adding a lot of that in there that sometimes it feels very direct to us, mm-hmm. but it doesn't come into the same level of directness as the product manager. And they can feel really kind of abrupt to a designer when they give feedback. And you're like, well, why did you just come in and just start doing that? And I think there is, and it's some level of assertiveness. It's a lot of the things we talked about, different ways they give feedback. But there is, I think, some of that tension point can come in from that that piece where one feels steamrolled and the other feels like, why didn't they say anything? And they're like, I did, but you just didn't hear it the same way. So anyway.
That's actually, that's a point I slightly glossed over in the facilitation one. But there's something else I talk about with facilitation, which is so similar to this, is like when you're in that meeting with those different personality types, like how are you designing the meeting in such a way that they're kind of equally heard? Like the classic version of this is like the hippo, right? The highest paid person in the room can tend to take over the conversation, depending on, you know, who you're working with. But like that, that is on average. So yeah, like how are you getting those other people in the rooms voices heard? Because they are probably contributing to the decision-making as well. And that hippo probably actually wants to hear what they have to say, even though sometimes they do like the sound of their own voice.
Yes.
So yeah, I think that's an interesting one. That's maybe not, I like this kind of personality clash. Maybe that's another chapter I think.
It is true though, like getting all the voices heard, I have the type of personality, I have no problem speaking and taking, like I like to brainstorm, like there's no, but I have learned that if I'm really looking to brainstorm, I have to spend the time to structure it in a different way. I'm great on a free form, just throw up a book, but like that isn't fair to others. And the other thing I do, and this is so silly, but like if I'm going to brainstorm with someone, I'm going to try really, really hard not to think about it ahead of time.
Wow. That's smart. I quite like that.
And it doesn't work because I don't want to, I will come with ideas. I will sound like I have a solution when I don't mean to, and I might get attached to an idea, right? So I really, really try not to. That is like a trick I just grew into recently. So it obviously took me quite some time to realize that, you know, I would set up a brainstorming, but I'd been thinking about it so long. And then I was like, gosh, why aren't they brainstorming with me where I am? I was like, well, it's because you've been brainstorming in your own head for like 2 weeks. That's not fair. That's not, yeah.
Yeah. You're way ahead. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I like that. That's a good one.
So when we talk about these power skills, which are awesome and I love it, but like we've talked along the way a little bit about how to use, but if you were to someone who was like, you're talking to someone and they're like, you know what, I do need to build up my conflict management skills, right? And how to give good feedback, that kind of thing. Or what would you suggest? How does someone start to really work on some of these skills?
Yeah. So I actually think it's really helpful to do a bit of a self-reflection exercise. So one thing I did last year with a group of designers was we actually did like an old school like worksheet. Like, oh my God, I printed out pieces of A4 paper with questions on them. I'm sorry.
We're two pencils. So we can
Yeah. 2B pencils. And basically, like, you can pick what the skills are. Like, I use the four I talked about. So there's facilitation, conflict management, momentum, and self-management. And you basically kind of grade yourself on each of these skills, say from a 0 to 10 scale. Like 0 is, I never do this, I'm not very good at this. 10 is like, I'm the best of the world at facilitation. So you kind of rank yourself currently and maybe also rank yourself on where you want to be, say in a year or two. And then have a look at, okay, so where are the biggest gaps? So is, say, momentum the thing I really need to work on, or facilitation? Mm-hmm. And then once you have that, so that's like the strengths and weaknesses piece, right? And once you have that, then maybe go back and think about some of these tips that I've talked about for the specific skills. So say things like facilitation. How could you create the time and space to bring some of those kind of structural things and some of those context pieces into your project plan for the next time you want to facilitate, say, a kickoff workshop at the start of a project? The other thing I would say is really important is, particularly if you're a bit less senior, like talk to your boss about, am I being graded on this stuff? And if not, should I be? And like maybe if you have a progression plan at the moment, like how could these kind of power skills and soft skills be integrated into that? Because in my experience, they're not in there at the moment.
No, it tends to be very fair.
The hard skills and the technical skills. Maybe a few things like facilitation, but not really things like, say, momentum and self-management. I don't see that kind of stuff. So that's another thing I would recommend. Just talk to your boss about how can I be setting up goals for myself on these things. And actually, that reminds me, one of the other things I was going to talk about is, I'll just cover it quite quickly. The progression I did from senior to lead at Elsewhen was basically, I had exactly what I'm describing, right? We had actually a pretty nice like progression framework that had a few power skills in there, but not a lot. And I just had this gut feeling that, because we had a lead designer at that time, and I don't know, I just felt like he was doing a bunch of stuff that wasn't on this list, you know, the classic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was like, I feel like even if I do all the stuff on this list, you might not see me as a lead. So what is that like nebulous,
intangible feeling? Yeah.
It's missing. So what I did, and I'd recommend other people, feel free to steal my process and follow it because it seems to work quite well, is I actually like interviewed a few people at Elsewhen that were lead, including this guy. And it was like, okay, first of all, how did you progress into lead? Like, what were the little micro behaviors you started doing that people started noticing around you? Even if it wasn't at Elsewhen, even if it was two jobs ago, you know? And yeah, like what are they basically like, what do they feel are those leadership behaviors? A little bit, I suppose, of tangential from power skills, but I would say, like I mentioned at the start, leadership skills and power skills are very similar. So basically, I basically treated it like a little research study, like with like 3, 4, 5 interviews with these leads at Elsewhen, put that all on a board, kind of affinity mapped it all. And basically the outcome of that, alongside my kind of like progression analysis and the tool we already used, brought together these kind of 3 or 4 very personalized progression goals for myself that were like hybrid, basically behavioral power, leadership skills, whatever you want to call that, and a bit of technical skills in there as well, because, you know, that is kind of what we get graded on. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, basically ended up with these really clear goals that I could work towards for the year. And then ended up doing that stuff and getting the promotion. So that worked out.
Yeah. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
But second of all, I mean, it's a really smart approach, because I think you could look at the people who are leaders in your organization, whether it's I'm a lead, or you're like, if I was to name the leaders, and if you looked at their job description, to your point, that's not it, all of it. Yeah. And if you looked at their skills breakdown, that's not what makes them that.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we all know, but I don't know that any of us have thought about it in this sort of structured way. Great. Let's figure out what it is, what's filling up those spaces in between that really makes someone successful. And I think interviewing a variety is a really interesting way. And also when you're talking about the workshop you did where everybody, I'm switching topics for a second here, but everybody sort of had their worksheet and they graded themselves.
Yeah.
I think that's really smart. I also wonder, are we self-aware enough? Is there a value in feedback from others where they're like, ooh, you think you're not good at this? I think it's actually one of your strengths. You're just harder on yourself because it matters more to you. Or you might think you're great at this, but...
Yeah, great point. Like, especially think facilitation. I think great facilitators have super high facilitation standards. So like you know, to me and you, they're like 99% of the world's best facilitator. For them, they might be like, oh, I'm like 60%. Because I know so much about facilitation that I know all the stuff that I'm not doing.
Right, exactly.
Like any other person, they would be amazing. So yeah, I really like that. Maybe there's another version of this like self-reflection that you actually do with your team. Although I would say,
It's tough who to ask, right?
It's tough because this kind of stuff is a little bit more vulnerable, actually, than the technical skills stuff. So it's a tricky one, but I do like that. And I'm a massive fan of that, like 360 peer feedback, whatever you call it. I think that's super, super important. Also, try not to just do that once a year. Try and do that like 2-3 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
You work on stuff through the year, right? With different people. Yeah. So yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah. And I'm not, it's a little scary sounding because you're going to put yourself out there, and I'm not sure who the right person to ask is, but there's something there. I think even if it's like, these are the things I want to work on, right? Yeah. So you've already said, I want to work on it. Help me do that. There are some people who will be happy to help you. And then there are some who are like, nope, I don't do that. Okay. The other thing about like, so we talk about building them. I also think there's like the demonstrating the skills. Yeah. And I think we touched a little bit about this too, but I do want to underscore, like, I don't think you don't have to wait for someone to grant you the opportunity to demonstrate these skills, right? These are things you can do from where you are standing today and find different ways to do them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I think almost like no matter what level you are, no matter what role you are, like if you're like a junior graphic designer and you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure there are ways that you can be using it's like self-management. That's an obvious one, right? Like I talked to my boyfriend, fiance, that works in finance about him improving at self-management. Cause like, you know, he works 14 hours a day. I don't work 14 hours a day and he seems to get less done than I do. So I'm like, are you using your calendar to-do list today? Mm-hmm. So I think you can use it basically whatever level or role you are, and it can be just as helpful. And you might find it, you know, you progress a bit faster if you use these. So yeah.
Awesome. All right. This has been incredible, Rochelle. And we've talked about a ton of different things. If you are going to have listeners do 2 things differently tomorrow, based on what we talked about today, what would you do?
Okay. Thing number one, really easy thing. Start using the calendar to-do list. I cannot recommend that enough. Works wonders. Very practical thing you can do. Thing number 2, I mean, I just think it's great. Like, do the first step in the self-reflection thing just take 10 minutes out of your day. And, you know, even if you just do it on your notepad or whatever, just think about, like, what are the kind of power skills that I'm, that are my strengths? And what are the kind of power skills that are my weaknesses? And that will just give you like a pretty basic base to start thinking about how you can be improving at these things, and maybe give you something to talk to your boss about at your next kind of check-in on how you can be maybe improving at some of them. So yeah.
Great advice. All right, Rachel, thank you for taking the time to share your story and your perspectives here at Design Chats. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. It's been a pleasure to be here.
All right. That does it for today's episode. Thank you everyone for listening. And don't forget, if you want to learn more about how to contribute more strategically, drive value, build influence, be sure to check out all the resources at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.